interest. And yeah, there is a military industrial complex that profits from wars. That's true. But that all disguises the fact that what Elliot Abrams really represented here. So as I said at the beginning, I think this is a good idea. I think they should form a Jewish party. If you want Jewish interests, if you want America to serve Jewish interests, then vote for Elliot Abrams and all of his formerly known as neoconservative friends.
Biden's reluctance to continue down the path of neocons and other warmongers in the U.S. ruling establishment aside, the U.S. is practically unable to keep going down that road. On the other hand, multiple U.S. wars waged over the past decades indicate that the United States is a warning power, as it has not won any of them. Yet Washington wants to continue its wars at its costs. Most observers, strategists, and political scientists, as well as sitting and former officials in the U.S. and the wider West, believe that America's clout has long been under decline and the country is no longer capable of acting like the good cop it has portrayed itself to be.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A gunman opened fire at a birthday party in Colorado, killing six adults before killing himself, police said on Sunday, 9th of May. The shooting incident happened just after midnight on Sunday in a mobile home park on the east side of Colorado Springs, according to police. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Associated Press news agency. The piece is titled, Colorado Shooting, Seven Dead After Man Opens Fire at Birthday Party. Stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. A gunman opened fire at a birthday party in Colorado, killing six adults before killing himself, police said on Sunday, 9th of May. The shooting incident happened just after midnight on Sunday in a mobile home park on the east side of Colorado Springs, according to police. Police officers arrived at the trailer to find six dead adults and a man with serious injuries who died later at a hospital, the Colorado Springs Gazette reported. The suspected shooter was the boyfriend of a female victim at the birthday party, attended by friends, family, and children. He walked inside and opened fire before shooting himself, police said. The birthday party was for one of the people killed. Neighbor Jennifer Reyes told the Denver Post she woke to the sound of many gunshots. I thought it was a thunderstorm, Jennifer Reyes said. Then I started hearing sirens. Police brought children out of the trailer and put them into at least one patrol car, she said, adding that the children were crying hysterically. Authorities say the children who weren't hurt in the attack have been placed with relatives. Police on Sunday hadn't released the identities of the shooter or the victims. Authorities say a motive for the shooting incident wasn't immediately known. My heart breaks for the families who have lost someone they love and for the children who have lost their parents, Colorado Springs Police Chief Vince Nisky said in a statement. It was Colorado's worst mass shooting incident since a gunman killed 10 people at a Boulder supermarket on 22nd of March this year. The tragic shooting in Colorado Springs is devastating, Colorado Governor Jared Polis said on Sunday, especially as many of us are spending the day celebrating the women in our lives who have made us the people we are today. Colorado Springs, a town with a population of 465,000, is Colorado's second biggest city after Denver. In March of this year, 10 people were killed in a shooting at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado. In 2015, a man shot 3 people to death at random before dying in a shootout with police in Colorado Springs on Halloween. Less than a month later, a man killed 3 people, including a police officer, and injured 8 others in a shooting incident at a Planned Parenthood clinic in the city. Police officers responded shortly after midnight to a shooting incident at the Canterbury Mobile Home Park, where they found 6 adults dead and 1 man with serious injuries, the Colorado Springs police said. He was taken to hospital, where he died. The children who were in the home at the time were not injured and are staying with relatives, according to police. The police on Sunday were trying to determine a motive for the incident. The names of the victims and the gunman will be released by El Paso County Coroner, according to the authorities. Colorado Governor Jared Polis said the shooting on Mother's Day was devastating, especially as many of us are spending the day celebrating the women in our lives who have made us the people we are today. Multiple lives were taken today by this terrible act of violence, he said, families torn apart, and at a birthday party, no less. The Mobile Home Park, which is just west of the Colorado Springs Airport and about 6 miles southeast of the city's downtown, has a pool, a playground, and nearly 500 mobile home lots. Words fall short to describe the tragedy that took place this morning, Vince Nisky, the chief of the Colorado Springs Police Department, said in a statement. The statement added, "As a chief of police, as a husband and a father and a grandfather, as a member of this community, my heart breaks for the families who have lost someone they love and for the children who have lost their parents." Police Chief Nisky said that officers and investigators were left incredibly shaken. John Southers, a mayor of Colorado Springs, called the shooting incident a senseless act of violence.
Ministry.
On the eve of Al-Quds Day 2021, which falls on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan, Al-Quds appears on the cusp of an important transformation that will break the stagnation that has hit the Palestinian revolutionary street since the start of the corona pandemic. As the Israeli incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque intensifies, with Jewish extremists taking the lead in those incursions, with increasing numbers reaching hundreds a week, sparks of Palestinian protests and marches ignited the streets of Old Jerusalem since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. However, the peak was last week's mobilization of illegal colonial settlers aiming to break the Palestinian youth gathering during nighttime at Bab al-Amud, one of the main gates of the old city of Jerusalem. As a result, the Palestinian youths exploded in a majestic scene to a point that the settlers, who were armed to their teeth, could not hold in the face of Palestinian anger. Even the attempt to close the mosque in front of the worshippers failed, as more than 70,000 native Palestinians showed up to attend prayers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Those who could not reach the mosque surrounded the old city with prayers in front of the Israeli occupation soldiers. Things could not look worse for the occupation as we approach the International Al-Quds Day later this week. Israel fears this day every year as people around the world, Muslims and non-Muslims, come together to demonstrate their support for the oppressed Palestinians who have been living under the Israeli occupation for 73 years. Imam Khomeini, the founder and late leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, marked International Al-Quds Day in 1979, aiming to keep Al-Quds in the hearts and minds of all Muslims worldwide who marched to proclaim their support of the free nation of Palestine. 42 years later, Al-Quds remains steadfast as it was on the first day the British forces accompanied Zionist extremist mercenaries to occupy the Holy Arabian city. Whether through massive rallies inside the occupied city, defensive retaliatory missiles from Gaza in support of their Jerusalemite brothers, or acts of boycott by the rest of the world, Al-Quds Day unites us all for the sole purpose of liberating Palestine. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. Al-Quds Day is not a day to celebrate a city in occupied Palestine. It is the last Friday in the holy month of Ramadan, launched by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, to reiterate that the issue of Al-Quds Sharif is the core of the Palestinian cause. It is a day for every free soul to acknowledge that the only just solution for the perpetual conflict between Arabs and the Zionist illegal Israel is the ending of the occupation and the return of the city of Al-Quds to Palestinian sovereignty as the capital of the state of Palestine. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Omar Nashabi, political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us. Dr. Nashabi, now International Quds Day is seen as the legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, back in 1997, shortly after leading an Islamic revolution which toppled the Shah of Iran. He named the last Friday of Ramadan as the International Al-Quds Day. How do you think Palestine has benefited from this day?
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show, and Ramadan Kareem. Yes, I think that, the fact that the last Friday of this holy month of Ramadan is proclaimed by Imam Khomeini as Quds Day is a reminder to the whole world of the this cause, this just cause of the Palestinian people to get back what belongs to them. And it is against this violation of fundamental rights and principles, you know. And this is a call where that keeps the cause alive at a time when the whole world is turning its back on Palestine. So this is a holy month for all Muslims and all Arabs and all people concerned with this issue. This wasn't a call for a specific group. It was a call for international solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle for basic rights and in facing Israel that has violated so many of the international laws and so many of the international resolutions that are about the basic rights of Palestinians.
And you think they have benefited from this day so far?
Yes, definitely, because it has brought back every time of the year on the last Friday of Ramadan, Muslims all over the world, you know, get together to actually call for justice in Palestine, and that is an international a coalition or an international solidarity that is essential to keep this cause alive in order to bring justice to the people of Palestine and to Muslims all around the world. This is the Jerusalem Al-Quds is a holy place for all Muslims and Christians all around the world. And that is why to actually talk about it and come together at this time of the year, at the time, at this month, this holy month when the Quran came from the angel to the Prophet Muhammad, you know, is an important time for all Muslims everywhere.
Well, Dr. Nashabi, in recent weeks, we did see that the Israeli occupation forces increase their aggression against the native Palestinians, especially in occupied Al-Quds, where we saw a lot of protests from the Palestinians against the Israelis, that is. But also we saw a lot of settler provocations, chanting death to Arabs and other provocative chants. How do you assess the silence of the international community, on top of which is the United Nations silence on such incremental genocide against the native Palestinians?
Well, I think the settlers and the Israeli regime and the Zionists are profiting from the fact that there is an international crisis currently with Corona, with economic difficulties. The United Nations is preoccupied with other issues that are issues of basic health, with the spread of the virus and how to secure the vaccine. The Arab world is preoccupied with the issues of, after the Emirates signed this agreement with the Israelis, mm-hmm. They are going to naturalization of relations with Israel. So I think the actual settlers and the Zionists have profited from this regional situation and international situation to increase their attacks on Palestinians and expand their occupation of neighborhoods inside East Jerusalem. And this is what they have been doing. They have been throwing families, Palestinian families, out of their homes, out of their neighborhoods, and they've been taking their homes. And everybody can see that in the social media and in the media coverage, despite the fact that the media coverage is limited, but no one is doing anything about it. And that will encourage them to actually increase their occupation.
Well, to make things just worse, we had the occupation forces pave the way for the extremist far-right Jews to stage the anti-Arab marches that I told you about. But there's something that's very important that happened in Al-Quds, in occupied Al-Quds, and then we saw some certain factor of retaliation come from Gaza at the same time. Gaza started retaliatory attacks to try and also support their brothers in Jerusalem. What are your current prospects toward an ignition of another intifada if this just continues? We have Sheikh Jarrah, we have the Al-Quds protests, we have Gaza.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a feeling that there are elements within the Palestinian Authority that are acting as agents for some Arab states and some Arab nations that have signed a deal with Israel. And their function and their job is to put down any Palestinian sentiment and the organization to actually launch a new intifada. However, the Palestinian people and the violation of their basic right cannot stop them from rebelling against this oppression. And I think that, and I hope that the Palestinian people in the West Bank and in Gaza will reunite their efforts, and they will take to the streets again, because there are things that are unbearable. I mean, even if you actually do whatever effort to stop the people from saying no to occupation, you will not be successful, despite the fact that, for example, the elections have been taken to another date, they have been postponed, and that is really not to the benefit of the Palestinians. The Palestinian people, I think, are feeling that they are alone in this struggle. Mm-hmm. And they are moving forward, and I think they are organizing their ranks. However, in some places, they are desperate. The whole world has abandoned them, except some nations like the Islamic Republic of Iran and Syria and Lebanon, mm-hmm. Whereas the rest of the world that used to, at least only in words in the past, the Arab League used to show solidarity with the Palestinian people, now It's not only not even in words. There's no sign of any solidarity with these people. They are left alone.
Exactly. This is how the Palestinians are feeling inside of the occupied Palestine or the occupied Palestinian territory. But this is the first year when we have Al-Quds Day, where we have also Arab normalization with the Israeli entity. Everyone is turning a blind eye, just like you said, to the sufferings of the Palestinians, whether inside or outside. There are people outside who want to return to their ancestors' land, to their land, but still, it's not possible because of this normalization
How do you think
this normalization would actually affect the essence of Al-Quds Day?
Yes, I want to add a remark that some Arab states. They say that, their problem, they have a problem with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they consider that their problem with the Islamic Republic of Iran will make them move away from the central issue that is Jerusalem. This is just a pretext for not doing their moral duties to stand by the Palestinians. They take a pretext that, yes, that the Islamic Republic of Iran is holding the cause of Palestine as a primary cause, hence they do not want to actually take that cause into consideration. That is a ridiculous justification for their continuous treason of the central issue that is the Palestinian issue, that is the violation of Palestinian and Arab, Islamic, and Christian rights in Palestine. And that has been going on for a long time, but now it has culminated with this naturalization.
I think the last Friday
of the month of Ramadan is an opportunity for all Arabs and all Muslims and all people around the world to show that the issue of Palestine is an issue of basic right. It has nothing to do with the interests.
This is what the Palestinians, Dr. Nashavi, are doing and continue to do, despite the fact that they are suffering, and their sufferings might not be heard by a lot of Arab states, but they continue with the resistance, and that's the most important factor to liberate, hopefully, Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us to discuss the upcoming International Al-Quds Day. Dr. Omar Nashavi, political writer and commentator from Beirut. Please stay tuned. We will be talking next about the upcoming liberation of Maghreb.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Yemeni armed forces and the popular committees continue their accelerated advance in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, where the U.S.-led Saudi coalition of aggression against Yemen is facing a major dilemma as a result of their failure to halt the advancement of the Yemeni resistance. Meanwhile, the death of a large number of leaders of the forces loyal to Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi during the past 2 weeks on the front lines of Ma'rib exacerbated inter-accusations of treason inside the Saudi Emirati coalition camp. More details in this following report. The former and current U.S. administration, in cooperation with Israel, the Saudi royal family, the UAE, Sudan, Turkey, and Daesh mercenaries, mobilized more than 30,000 armed men and supplied them with the latest weapons and entrusted the Minister of Defense of Hadi and Saudi officers to lead the battle to keep Ma'rib under Saudi occupation. But why Ma'rib exactly? Ma'rib is important for its strategic location on the border with Saudi Arabia. It is an important water hub for Yemen and a large source of oil and gas income for Yemen. That is why we see the U.S.-led Saudi aggression pushing towards the Battle of Ma'rib. For its liberation means the first breath Yemen takes after 6 years of deliberate suffocation. Finalizing the Battle of Ma'rib could have been accomplished by the Yemeni resistance forces some time ago, but the quick control of Ma'rib would not have ended the roles of Saudi leaders and members of terrorist organizations in the governorate. They would have just fled to other governorates to continue their terrorist war on Yemen. This understanding of the slow progression in resolving the Battle of Ma'rib leads to a better evaluation of the special operations that the army forces and the joint committees have resorted to during the past week.
The Yemeni armed forces and the resistance selected specific targets of importance, including gathering points of invaders and mercenary forces. Observers believe that the Yemeni resistance was able to implement its will due to innovation and strategic planning for the battle. Today, neither the Air Force is able to control the battle, nor the rush of many Al-Qaeda mercenaries to the front lines to provide a safe withdrawal of the Hadi forces. Meanwhile, Mohammed bin Salman's statements about ceasefire negotiations and the Arabism of Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi means that the Saudi army is in a state of defeat and fragmentation due to the grave losses in Ma'rib, as well as the inability of the Saudi army to at least defend the Saudi-Yemeni border. Mohammed bin Salman's embellished speeches about Arabism, Islam, and negotiations come from his media advisors who have so far proven their failure, whether in promoting his unjustified aggression against Yemen or in saving face by trying to end it.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, who's a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, Ma'rib seems to have become a very important military shift in the balance of power between the U.S.-led Saudi aggression against Yemen and the Yemeni resistance, on the other hand, especially that U.S. efforts are underway to try and halt any progress for the Yemeni resistance and the armed forces. How do you perceive the recent developments on the ground in Ma'rib will change this balance of power?
Thank you for hosting me.
My pleasure.
Of course, Ma'rib is an important city, just not because it's close to Sana'a, but because it's the last stronghold of the U.S.-Saudi-led coalition waging its war on Yemen. Because if you take a look at the map, you will see that in northern Yemen, there is only Ma'rib kept to be liberated. So it's important for Sana'a, and it's important also for Saudi Arabia and also Al-Islah Party, because it's the stronghold for Al-Islah Party. There is also some important strategic facilities to the east of Ma'rib. You got the oil and gas facilities. So if Sana'a controls completely Ma'rib and puts its hand on the oil and gas facilities, then they will have more electricity, they will have more power, they will have some features and services to provide to the 20 million population in northern Yemen. That means that Saudi Arabia would not be able to use the paper of the shipments, the oil shipments, mm-hmm. and you know, all the gas and oil that is necessary for the lives of those 20 million Yemenis. So it's important for both sides. I believe that the Sana'a government wants to have full control on Ma'rib gradually, and not by all forces in, because they know there is a tribal situation in Ma'rib that Ansarullah want to keep their relations with them in the coming future, because it's important for the future of Yemen. Mm-hmm. We are not talking about a completely military battle taking place in Ma'rib. It's also a social and a political battle
that
Sana'a is winning
so far.
So
basically, the Yemeni resistance basically wants to keep its relations up with the clans and the tribes and not have blood separate
exactly.
between them for the future of Yemen. But what is worth mentioning here is the recent death of the Director of Officers Affairs, as well as the Director of the Military Judiciary Department in the so-called Hadi forces, in addition to the death of many other Saudi generals as well. In this strategic and military sense, how do you interpret the presence of first-rank officers and generals at the front lines of Ma'rib losing their lives under the command of Mohammed bin Salman's coalition of aggression?
Of course, Mohammed bin Salman is treating Ma'rib as its last, his last stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
If he loses Ma'rib, then he will be declared as a loser in Yemen, a formal loser in Yemen, because if you take a look on the to the south, actually Saudi Arabia doesn't have any influence kept in the south.
It's rather the UAE.
Yes, exactly, to the Emiratis, through their militias and the so-called, the elite brigades and the giants brigades. All those names, they are controlled by Abu Dhabi. And actually, Saudi Arabia doesn't have any influence and power in the south. So if Marib is fallen into the hands of Ansarullah and the government in Sana'a, then Mohammed bin Salman has nothing kept to stand on in Yemen. So I think that he is desperate. That's why he is pushing his generals and also the generals of the so-called Yemeni army aligned to Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi and Al-Islah Party. It's a carnage. It's a carnage. They are killing their generals for no purpose, actually, mm-hmm. because they know they are losing the ground and they are losing the tribes, and this is the most important thing than losing grounds.
And this is what actually the Yemeni resistance is investing in. They are investing in them losing the tribes,
yes.
and them, the Yemeni Sana'a government winning it. But let us discuss a bit the statement of Mohammed bin Salman that happened like a week ago. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, where he considered Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi as a Yemeni and an Arab. Wallah, thank you very much. And that he wished to sit with him at the negotiations table. I personally read that as a clear Saudi defeat. How do you decipher Mohammed bin Salman's statements?
I agree with you completely, because if Mohammed bin Salman had won his battles on the ground, he wouldn't speak this way when talking about Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. Of course, because he is defeated, he is using this soft tone and he is offering talks and dialogue. I think his main purpose now is to stop the Battle of Marib.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to reach an agreement, just like the agreement of Al-Hudaydah, which was signed in 2019 in Sweden. And by the way, the Saudi part didn't abide by the agreement at all. That's why they are trying to repeat the process by reaching an agreement for Marib, and they will not abide by in the future. But I think that Sana'a is aware about this scheme, and I think they are completely clear. They said from the end, no talks, no peace, unless you stop your air raids, your bombings, and also you lift the siege, mm-hmm. which is more important, I think, than the all the military battles taking place.
So in order for that to happen, we just have less than a minute now. In order for that to happen, what do you think is a plausible and real option for everyone here in order to get rid at least of the humanitarian crisis and just break that blockade?
I think that the Americans, in the first place, they have to be straight. The Biden administration is beating about the bush. They are making games. Lender King is saying openly that his main purpose is to stop the Battle of Marib. They are using the humanitarian issue as a paper of war, as a means of war. So I think the United States and Saudi Arabia, they have to make their minds. Do they want to this war to proceed, mm-hmm. to continue? They claim that they want to end it, but on the grounds, the opposite is what we see.
Well, we have to wait and see then what happens, especially basically after the end of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, because this is how things are being shown on the ground, that the Yemeni resistance might have something very important when Eid comes over. Thank you very much for being with us, Musa Ali Murad, political commentator, to discuss how the Yemeni resistance is fighting to liberate Ma'rib. Now, thank you for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Most officers at the George Floyd protest received only vague academy training that emphasized arresting protesters over defending their rights. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Alice Sperry and John Bolger, authors. The article is published under the heading Internal NYPD documents show cops were sent to protest with barely any First Amendment training. Here's more. In the aftermath of the U.S. police brutality displayed during last summer's uprising, a series of official reports denounced the department's failure to adequately train officers ahead of the protest. Most cops had not received protest-related training since leaving the academy years or even decades earlier. The reviews drew a distinction between the Strategic Response Group, a heavily militarized rapid response unit that has an estimated 700 members and receives specialized training, and the rest of the NYPD's 35,000 uniformed officers. In a 115-page report, the Department of Investigation, an independent agency overseeing city government, concluded that, other than for personnel assigned to SRGDOI, found that prior to the Floyd protest, NYPD lacked standardized agency-wide in-service training related to policing protests. The DOI added NYPD appears to have deployed a large number of frontline supervisors and officers to police the Floyd protest without adequate training. The conclusion was echoed by the city's law department, the Office of the Corporation Counsel, which wrote in its own report that for a majority of the officers who were assigned to the George Floyd protest, their training on policing protests was limited to what they had received as recruits in the academy. When criticized for using force against protesters last summer, the NYPD responded in part by noting that Hundreds of its officers were injured in the course of doing their job. Yet the police was heavily involved in some of the most brutal repression of protests in the wake of Floyd's killing last summer, including the violent arrest of at least 263 people police had trapped in the streets at a June 4th protest in the Bronx. Last month, The Intercept published a series of SRG training documents that reflect the unit's heavily-handed approach to the policing of protests, coaching cops on tactical maneuvers and mass arrest scenarios, as well as providing additional training for SRG's distinctive armor-clad bike squads. The DOI noted that while it was unable to conduct a full assessment of the new training, it determined that much of it appeared to consist of disorder control tactics like those deployed by the SRG. As documents obtained by the attorneys over the years reveal, little has changed about the NYPD's protest-related training despite countless lawsuits and court rulings critical for its conduct. In a class-action lawsuit seeking to represent hundreds of protesters arrested last summer, attorneys argued that the NYPD failed to train its officers about how to protect First Amendment activity since at least the 1990s, when the DCU was created. Despite the wealth of evidence of NYPD's members' historical brutality against protesters, the city has ignored and or failed to utilize relevant information, including information gleaned from reports and lawsuits, as well as other data points, to identify deficiencies in NYPD training as it relates to constitutionally complained protest policing. While none of that recent history features into the NYPD's training documents, the materials do refer to the police position historically as the target of protest they are tasked with controlling. In fact, most of the riots in this country over the last half century have been started by what, justifiable or not, were believed by citizens to have been abuses of police discretion, the documents note. It is sobering to reflect on all the damage that has been caused by controversial decisions made by police officers on the street. Training materials say in recent years some of the most serious allegations of police discretion have been claims that it has been abused and degenerated into racial profiling. The documents warn officers that demonstrators feel strongly about their cause and call on them to recognize this intensity, treat it objectively and professionally, and not allow ourselves to be hooked into the emotion of the moment. The resulting violence, the documents suggest, was not a matter of lone cops going rogue, but policy deliberately sanctioned by department leadership. The fact that conduct may be permitted under the First Amendment does not mean that the government cannot regulate that conduct in some way if the overwhelming needs of the rest of society require it. The documents note, citing traffic congestion, pedestrian congestion, and inconvenience to others as justification for intervention. That kind of approach, implying that constitutional rights should only be protected enough to avoid legal repercussions, are indicative of an underlying antagonism by police toward protesters that no amount of training can fix, critics have long maintained. A better solution to avoid violent repression of protests, they add, is considering whether police need to be there in the first place. Why are there so many police at protest? Do we even need police at protest? Ask Kang of Communities United for Police Reform, adding that, at best, police at protest handle traffic control that can easily be left to civilians, and at worst, They escalate tensions and infringe on protesters' rights. There is a much bigger question of what's the role, and should police even have a role?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
Those who confine the Quran and Islam to personal matters, acts of worship and other such issues, who invite people to sit in a corner and who tell them to put aside the Quran once they enter into society, do not have a correct understanding of the Quran. They are really not familiar with the Quran. One should say that they have not read the Quran. That is why they make such mistakes and such wrong judgments. They are really not familiar with the Quran. The Quran does not stand aside when it comes to political and social challenges, and it does not refrain from confronting falsehoods, the arrogant, the wasteful, and the oppressor. On the contrary, it has always stood up against them. If you are men of the Quran, thus the Quran should be present in the heart of your life. Therefore, the Quran has undertaken human guidance and assistance in all areas. There is no doubt about this.
Ramadan, ya shahr al-Qur'an, fika adhuq halawat al-Iman. La la tanqadi, anta lil-ruhi dawa. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan. ليتك دوما قريب
Despite the fact that the Quran is available to us, whether we can benefit from it is an important issue in itself. The Quran has provided us with the lesson and the guidance. But when can we benefit from it? In it is sure guidance without doubt for the muttaqeen. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse number 2. When we have piety, the Quranic guidance will be available to us in the real and true senses of the word. Of course, there are different terms in the Quran, but they all refer to one single concept. In this ayah, which is in the beginning of the Holy Quran, God says, Muttaqeen. In other ayah, God says, and guidance and glad tidings for those who believe. Chapter 2, verse 97. In another ayah, he says, a guide and a mercy to all who believe. Chapter 7, verse 52. And elsewhere he says, as a guide and glad tidings to Muslims. Chapter 16, verse 102.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, midnight is the best time for praying, supplication and being in communion with God. Yet the hours near to dawn are more significant for this purpose. Moreover, the midnights of the blessed month of Ramadan are more significant in this regard. Imam Khomeini used to make the best use of his midnights throughout his life, particularly in Ramadan. As you know, there are certain supplications that have been recommended to be recited at midnight and before dawn in Ramadan. One of these supplications is called Dua-e Sahar, or Supplication of Dawn. We have already given a very simple translation of this supplication in one of the episodes of our special series for Ramadan. Imam Khomeini wrote a book on explanation of this supplication in the prime of his youth. Today, we will touch upon this application and the Imam's views on it. Stay tuned, please. According to the Prophet of Islam, our breath and sleep in the blessed month of Ramadan have the reward of worship and glorification of God. Dua-e Sahar, or Supplication of Dawn, has such a high status that the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, said, "If people had known what benefits are in this supplication, they would have contested to gain them." Many ulama have said that this supplication is the mother of other supplications. They believe that if a faithful does not grasp the lofty concepts of this supplication, he will reside in the outskirts of paradise and will not be admitted to the main sanctuary of God. Allame Hasan Hasanzade Amuli is one of the top students of the renowned exegete of the Noble Quran, late Allame Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. Allame Hasanzade says that the supplication of dawn is very lofty because in most of other supplications, we plead to God for our demands and often ask Him to meet our needs. But in this supplication, we call God by His names and appeal to Him for those names. Indeed, in this supplication, we place God on oath with His names and attributes to gain His proximity. Great ulama maintain that even if one thousandth of what is asked in this supplication were fulfilled by God, it would bring about salvation and happiness both in this world and the hereafter. In Ayah 180 of Surah A'raf, we read, "To Allah belong the best names, so supplicate Him by them." As we said in the beginning of this episode, Imam Khomeini wrote an explanation to the supplication of Dawn. In fact, this book was his first Gnostic work, which he wrote at the age of 27. This coincided with the coming of Ayatollah Mirza Ali Shah Abadi to Qom. Although Imam Khomeini used to study Irfan or Islamic Gnosticism before that year, the coming of Ayatollah Shah Abadi to Qom was a turning point in Imam Khomeini's life, as the former was a very outstanding teacher of Irfan. Imam Khomeini used to highly venerate Ayatollah Shah Abadi. Later on, he said in his books that Ayatollah Shah Abadi was the greatest Gnostic that the Imam had seen or known. Imam Khomeini used Da'ye Sahar, or Supplication of Dawn, as an opportunity to explain God's best names that are Asma'ul Husna to the readers. He tried to elucidate deep and complicated Gnostic concepts of this supplication for ordinary readers. He says that his purpose of writing an explanation for this supplication is to pave the ground for formation of a spiritual bond between the creator and the creature or human being. He writes, "One of the greatest bounties for servants and the widespread mercy among the inhabitants of cities are the supplications that have been narrated from the treasures of revelation, religion, and the owners of knowledge and wisdom. Because it is these supplications which are the spiritual bond between the creator and the creature, and a means for entering the robust fort and clinging to that firm handhold and a strong cord. So, I intended to explain this supplication very briefly as far as I can with the little knowledge that I have." Interestingly, Imam Khomeini has written the simple explanation of the Supplication of Dawn as a young scholar. This shows that he was very heedful of making the best use of the period of youth for self-building and expurgation of the heart and the spirit. In his other books too, the Imam puts emphasis on the benefiting period of youth as the best time for gaining spiritual perfection.
Around the world with reporters.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups,